Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, fan.video, vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate the support. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Macroaggression, where I may or may not argue with robots. Legal Shield has been in business for 50 years. They're available in the United States and Canada. And what they do is it's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards high power law firms in the area. It gives you access to an attorney at a very reasonable price. How reasonable? Like $30 a month will get you access to an attorney that has on average 22 years of experience. So you're not going to get somebody fresh out of law school. If there are issues that you need handled by an attorney, do you have a last will and testament? You need one. Do you have a financial power of attorney, a medical power of attorney? All of these things are documents that as adults we've got to have. Nobody wants to spend the money to hire a lawyer to do this. It's going to cost you a couple grand. But I'll tell you what, if you're a member of Legal Shield, first thing you should do month one is set up an appointment with your attorney and go in and get these things knocked out, then fold them up, put them in your safe, and forget about them. The last thing in the world you want after you're dead is to have the state involved in your affairs. So make sure that you do something about that and be proactive as opposed to reactive. It's not just legal documents. They've got all kinds of things. They've got a small business plan that you can add on. If you're a gun owner or gun carrier, they have documentation for that. They have Identity Shield that can help you in with reputation management, credit monitoring, passwords, things like that. Look, there's a lot going on. I suggest just go to the website, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. That's the domain that's specific to us. You can take a look. If you need to, if the IRS is harassing you about a W-2 situation, send it to your attorney. If your work wants you to sign some weird new contract, employment contract that has language in there about forcing you to take advantage, you know, to be involved in their medical procedures, send it to your attorney. I mean, now you have access to it. Take a look, see what you think. I think it's a great investment. You're definitely going to get your money's worth on this one. Don'tgetpushedaround.com. Take a look. Also, EMP Shield, they're our newest sponsor. Hopefully you don't need it, but I'll tell you what, in this crazy world that we live in, you're better off being a couple months early than a day late. And if there's an EMP, solar flare, or lightning, you're going to be protected. The EMP shield is many more times more efficient than a single-use military design. It can handle up to 40 EMP strikes. I mean the world, you won't be able to handle 40 EMP strikes, I assure you, but this device will. It's fitted to the household circuit breaker with just four wires. It installs like a type 2 surge protector. It'll protect your home, your car, your boat, your RV, your generator, whatever you've got. It'll help. They've got bundle packages. So I'll tell you what, do this. Go to the website, www.empshield.com. Take a look. See what you think. See if it's a product that you need. If you find something you like, use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself a little bit of money. We're all going to need it. Well, I'm excited for this one. I mean, I'm excited for all of them, but I'm especially excited about this one because if you've been noticing a theme for the last couple of months with these shows, I have been deeply interested in eugenics, depopulation, the role of the old-timey British lunatics that wanted to thin the herd. And really, for my money, there's nobody better than Matt Arrett. He is a writer at The Last American Vagabond. He is a writer at Unlimited Hangout. And what's funny is that when people ask me where they can go to get some really good news and stories that aren't going to be watered down, I tell them, well, you could either go to The Last American Vagabond or you could go to Unlimited Hangout. But either way, you're going to find Matt's work. He's also an author. He's written of the Two Americas. He's the host of The Great Game on Rogue News. Oh my God. He's the director at Rising Tide Foundation. You're a busy guy, ladies and gentlemen. Matt Arrett. How are you, Matt?
Hey, Charlie. Good. Glad to finally be on your show. And we've had a chance to interact a little bit in the past, but I'm great. I'm glad that we're going to have a real in-depth conversation today. And yeah, I wear a lot of hats. But you know, the way I think about it is that if we were actually in, like, let's say, you know, World War II fighting actual Nazis, which we kind of are, back 80 years ago, I'd probably be fighting Nazis and like sleeping 3 hours a day, as our grandparents did in that generation. So here I am. I've got the benefit of living in a bit of comfort right now in my part of the transatlantic psycho part of the world. And I might as well use that time as you are as well, to its fullest.
I feel the same way. I've only got three podcasts, a radio show, and getting ready to start another book. So, you know, and all my family related stuff to take care of too. So yeah, it does feel like we're in a war. I mean, it's not a, maybe not like a hot war, at least not where we are, but it's an ideological war. And it feels like there is a coordinated effort against us. That obviously we see the media is used as a tool for this. But if I wasn't doing this, I really don't know what else I would be doing. It feels like a priority to me. And I always joke, like, all I want to do is I just want to do a football podcast at some point. You know, like I aspire to the day where all these problems are kind of gone and I feel like, okay, now I can just do a sports podcast and I won't feel too guilty about it. But you know, I unfortunately think that might be a ways away because we're up against some of these nefarious people. Real quick before we even get into the topic, Can we talk a little bit about your world tour? Because you're on a world tour, or at least you were, all over the place. What were you? Where were you? What were you promoting? What was happening?
Well, yeah. For the last 6 weeks, my wife and I, Cynthia, who's also she's a co-founder of the Rising Tide Foundation, and she's written her first book as well on the origins of international fascism, looking at British intelligence operations going back to the 19th century. And she's going to be doing volume two pretty soon as well. So we had a handful of things to do, but we had the first step was a speaking engagement in Ireland with a wonderful community of people who have really self-organized wonderfully in the face of the Great Reset and the depopulation agenda. That was it's very clear for the Irish, who have more of a living memory of the genocide that sometimes is euphemistically called the potato famine. As if the Irish of the 1850s only ate potatoes,
right?
And they had no wheat or cattle or anything else, right? No. So there's a conscious Malthusian genocide to consciously destroy the Irish people for a variety of reasons that we can maybe talk about later. So that living memory is more rich in the minds of the Irish. And so I think they were very quick to resonate to the reality of what is going on behind the surface appearance at Davos and other things. So we had a really huge conference sponsored by Sarah Habubi and her excellent team of colleagues at Making Sense. They've been doing this now every few months. Alex Craner came down. Ellen Brown, the public banking guru, a good friend of mine, also spoke. Catherine Austin Fitz spoke. So it was a strong event. John Waters, really, really solid guy in Ireland also. Ran for office, nice. Former mainstream guy, jumped out of the journalism and into reality, and has been a really, really awesome poet fighter since. So then we went to Ireland, to Switzerland. We had to the Belly of the Beast in Basel, which had another really wonderful conference. About 300 people showed up, all freaked out about the fact that there are obviously sacrificial lambs in Europe being set up for a nuclear war, and trying to figure out, how do you bridge East-West relations? How do you defuse the time bomb of weaponized, you know, the weaponized zeitgeist that has been led to believe that our enemy is not the international oligarchy, but rather Russia or China, who are the supervillains. And then that was good, 2 weeks. And then we ended up in Japan working on a sort of video project, as well as a little book deal to translate our books into Japanese. So that was fun. Now we just arrived back a few days ago.
It's fantastic. Yeah. When you were in Basel, Switzerland, I wonder, did you see the BIS? Did you see the building that they're not allowed to search you in, and it's immune from prosecution, and I think the laws of gravity don't even apply inside that building. See that?
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Yeah, it did, and it's a lot less impressive than the pictures. I was imagining this bigger Mordor style thing, or like the you know, MI6 headquarters in Britain, or HQ is thinking something more massive. But now it's a little building, little tiny thing. Yeah. Yeah, but that's the way it works, right? You know, nobody really anticipates the rabbit did it. They want to keep themselves kind of like physically minuscule, so that, you know, you don't appreciate the actual power that is wielded by this institution.
Yeah, well, they project like they've got a big dick, and then when you get there, it's just a little thing that you're unimpressive. Well, I hope that we can defeat these bastards. It seems like this has been an ideology that's shared by these people. These, you know, I started really talking about Cecil Rhodes and this whole group, the round table, and what comes out of that. And you start to get these think tanks that go on, Royal Institute for International Affairs, CFR. You guys in Canada have your own version of this. You have the Canadian Institute for International Affairs, I guess the Canadian CFR, or the Canadian Chatham House, however you want to define it. What has I didn't even really know that even existed, to be honest with you, until recently. What's their role? I think I can guess what their role is, but how powerful and influential are they in Canada these days?
Well, it emerged in the wake of the setup of a series of think tanks spread out around the Anglo-Saxon part of the British Empire. In the wake of Cecil Rhodes' death, and his trust was bequeathed to, and it was run by a Canadian, actually. He was the head of the trust, named George Parkins, who was the former head of Ontario Upper Canada College, and was the manager of this institution that was designed to carry out or fulfill the mandate set forth by Rhodes in his several wills. And I think the most clear and concise will was his 1877 draft, that called for the formation of a globally extended secret society under the Church of the British Empire in order to spread the white race, crush the weak, and reestablish the grandeur of Britain as a global Roman Empire that doesn't make the mistakes of the first Roman Empire. So see, a lot of these British higher geopolitical strategists, they have a very romantic view of what the Roman Empire was. And in their assessment, that was gleaned from a lot of the propaganda work by Decline and the Fall of the Roman Empire. What's his name? Blanking. Anyway, they commissioned a work, an assessment of what caused the Roman Empire to fall. And it was published in 1776. Not a coincidence. And it was Gibbons, Edward Gibbons. And they commissioned Gibbons as an appendage of the British Empire to assess and diagnose what went wrong with Rome, so that the British Empire, which at the time was the only global government that existed, the sun never set, right? Tiny little island, was able to control the globe, 25% of the world population, or the world surface area. So it's like, how did that little island do that? Well, they modeled themselves on the best of evil. So how could they avoid the missteps of the Roman Empire? And what Gibbon gets across is, on the one hand, there was a lack of cohesion in the auxiliaries. The managers needed to enforce the policies of a central command. Mm-hmm. And number two, Christianity. Gibbons was like, if they didn't have that pesky thing of Christianity emerge, there's no reason to say that Rome would not have been a perpetual, eternal empire of forever. So they're like, these two problems have to be corrected. Now, on the one hand, I mean, we are dealing with a satanic inner core of figures who see themselves made in the image of an evil creator. It's not like they don't have a cosmology or a metaphysics. They do. It's a very poisonous, toxic metaphysics, which projects sort of their own perversity onto all of creation and God. And then they like reconstruct a theology based on that with rituals. But so that part was sort of figured out, but they had a problem with the fact that, okay, so Britain, what's their religion? It's Anglican Christianity is the official religion of the British Empire. Okay, well, and I'm getting at this circuitously, and I'll answer the question on the Canadian Chatham House. But the problem with that is that, on the one hand, it's useful to have the head of state, the queen or the monarch, as also the head of church. So Britain is actually a theological. But at the same time, the problem is they're reading the Bible. So your managers, the civil servants, the governor generals of your colonies who are assigned to keep an evil system of population control in place and thus be on the ground watching people die when they're exerting a policy of, let's say, what's happening in Ireland under the British Empire's policy of population reduction, which was the potato famine. But it wasn't a potato famine. It was a genocide called after the fact a potato famine, never a potato famine. As if the Irish didn't have more than potatoes to eat, right? They had a full spectrum agricultural basket, but it was like that caused 2 million to die it was a policy of Malthusian population control. And that was one of the scientific organizing principles of the empire always was, whether for India or anywhere, keep the population low, stupid, fighting each other, divided and better, more easily malleable by a supernational elite. Simple formula.
That would never happen here.
No. Now we're in the Enlightened Age. We're so beyond Christianity because that was only made possible because of a religion, we're told. But anyway, the thing about the needing of managers to do this evil is that sometimes they actually read and thought about the Bible in the 19th century, and their conscience weighed on them. So you have a lot of cases in the 19th century of British auxiliaries within the civil service, including lords, people in the House of Lords themselves, who were calling for the dissolution of the British Empire because it runs against the principles of Christianity. You had people in Canada, the governor of British Columbia as a colony back before Confederation, was this guy Frederick Seymour. He was very, very against the murderous policies of the British Empire and was actually for helping the colonists then who were being strangled by the British to join up with Lincoln's America. That would have changed the contour of history in a very different way, but he had to be eliminated. So you couldn't really trust the managers to carry out their evil tasks. So Cecil Rhodes in his will, which was itself trained into him, I don't think he was anybody unto himself. He was like a sociopathic little underling wannabe high up. Like he wanted to be a house slave for the empire that he devoted himself to. But he had people like John Ruskin, who was another pathetic character who wanted to create, a spiritually coherent religion of ugliness around this ethic, this aesthetical ethic that he created out of Venice of decay as the absolute ideal of beauty. And he's a very influential person. I mean, the whole impressionist movement is highly influenced by Ruskin's theories of art and beauty. And he was one of the lecturers at Oxford who influenced and basically trained a young Cecil Rhodes and Milner and Parkins. Mm-hmm. And so they took on this mission in their life. And so, they're different stooges are assigned different tasks in the empire and Cecil Rhodes, due to certain connections with Victor Rothschild and certain higher up echelons within the Cecil family, which is another old family of the empire that goes back even before there was a British Empire, there was a Cecil family. He had certain patronage who saw his talent, set him to task in South Africa, today's Zimbabwe, an area that was Rhodesian, a big chunk of South Africa. And he did his job well. He raped, pillaged, created De Beers. It was a bad situation. Fought the Boers, destroyed the Transvaal Republic uprising, you know. But he was sick. He died. But his will and the massive bounty of money that he accumulated raping Africa was put forth for two things. So how do you actualize this Church of the British Empire with a more integrated, self-disciplined priesthood that would be the more reliable managers occupying positions of influence mm-hmm. within everything that has influence, media, corporate, private sector, public sector, civil service, whatever you can permeate. And this is where the idea of permeation theory that had been developed, or at least, I guess, refined by George Bernard Shaw and the Fabians, work very closely with the Oxford Rhodes Scholars. So the two ways you do that, and these two think tanks both had different tasks, but dance together. You can't treat one without the other. And so both of them integrated their operations, and often you have overlap throughout history. And yeah. We could say something about some of the case studies of that. Number one, think tanks are needed. So you need some infrastructure, think tanks being that, one occupying each of the core nodes of the empire with the focus on America. As Cecil Rhodes says in his 1877 will, the ultimate trophy is the reclamation of the belligerent colony of the United States back into the fold. Yeah. So he never even recognized he even called them the colonies in 1877. He was still referring to them as the colonies.
He's old school.
Oscar, yeah. Total denial. He never acknowledged that happened. The Round Table Movement was the name given with the idea was, well, you know, they've got a romanticized idea of medievalism. They like round table type of medieval imagery. It's tied to also some Templar ideas too. You know, one of the places where the Round Table Movement of Rhodes met was in a certain Templar temple in London, in the city of London. It's where they had some meetings.
Of course.
So there's a certain overlap there, which is a bit weird. And the other thing, so one in New Zealand, Australia, Great Britain, obviously, is the mother node controlling the other nodes. And then ultimately Canada. And the focus was always a round table movement in the United States, which couldn't be called that for its first years because there's too much awareness in the mind of Americans a century ago of the nature of the British Empire and its intrigue. So they couldn't they take a more subtle form. but in Canada, the Roundtable Movement of Canada was managed again by George Parkins. There's a whole bunch of Glasbrook. There's a whole bunch of people I go through in my book series. Vincent Massey, who becomes the first Canadian-born governor general, is a leading figure from an oligarchical family who does a lot of damage throughout the 20th century. Anyway, I could say more about him later, but they change names. So after World War I is over as it's ending, Britain has been taken control of. They've already gone through a 1916 coup, a soft coup, which was organized to oust Herbert Asquith and install Lord Milner, right, who is in charge. He's like the world leader of the Round Table Movement. He cut his teeth carrying out the first mass genocides against women and children during the Boer War uprising, where you had Zulus and Dutch working together, fighting together against the British oppressors. And the only way they were able to win that victoriously over the Dutch and the Boers was to take the war to the kids and the women, of which something like 28,000 or so were killed in these concentration camps, poisoning drinking water. And that's what Milner and what was called his kindergarten, Leo Amery. There's a whole nexus of Philip Kerr. There's a whole bunch of these little homo, young boys who are just all revolving around orgies together and stuff and worshiping their hero Milner image or whatever. And might be gay listening to this, and I'm not saying that this, I shouldn't have said homo, it just happens to be that they are.
I know,
but it's not a cause of their immorality, it's just that they happen to be that.
No, I mentioned that in my episode as well, that there was this underlying theme that was running through it, which is that there were a lot of closeted homosexual men, Cecil Rhodes being one of them, and others. And it seemed like...
And Ruskin, and they're all kind of that, but it doesn't mean that that's what made them bad. It's just that they happen to be that as a thing.
It's just I know it's
an observation, right?
Just an observation, yeah.
But Randall Elliott and his weird young agrarians in Harvard running the Oxford of Harvard as a Rhodes Scholar, shaping, you know, Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Pierre Elliott Trudeau, who are all being conditioned at Harvard under Yandel Elliott, who himself has been working, or he's part of the, you know, leader of the Nashville Agrarians. They're all pumping each other, you know? And it's weird. And they all have like again, a guru, elderly figure. And they do this is part of the custom of the boarding school process of Britain that was really refined as part of the grooming and conditioning process over centuries in Oxford and Cambridge and the higher echelons to prepare the minds and morals of young, useful tools who will go on to play positions of influence in the empire. I don't fully understand it. It's for maybe some sociologists of the future to discuss and nitpick, but that's the thing. Yeah. So that permeated. And like I said, Bernard Shaw was a key figure in organizing a sort of grand strategy that involved through the Fabian Society of the London School of Economics, permeating every institution, like I said, and spreading their doctrine. The other thing was Rhodes Scholarships. So you had the Round Table Movement, and it transformed itself during World War One or after World War One, when it gave itself a rebranding under the form of the Council on Foreign Relations in America. And in every other part of the Anglo-Saxon world, it was given Royal Institute of International Affairs for Canada, for Australia, for New Zealand, later on in 1932 in South Africa, apartheid South Africa. And that's how sort of they coordinated, but the actual people who would occupy the positions of the new cult or religion of the empire would be processed through Oxford in a very special set of experiences that they would be given under a scholarship program called the Rhodes Scholarship Program, of which to this day about 8,000 Americans have been processed and then repositioned back into whatever position of authority they have, Canada. That's without understanding these operations, you can't understand anything about Canada in the 20th century. Same thing for Australia. It's all this.
Chrystia Freeland is a famous one.
Yeah, wrote Bob Ray, who gave up his seat in Ontario when Chrystia was being tapped to go now into politics after being an intelligence operative against Russia in for Reuters. She was then tapped to say, okay, now you're going to be a handler of young Justin Idiot. And that means you got to be elected. So Bob Ray, the Rhodes Scholar, who worked with Maurice Strong to shut down Ontario's nuclear power sector in the 1990s. He then gives up, abrogates a seat and says, here, come sit here. Chrystia Freeland takes it up, and Bob Ray is now a major voice. He goes on to lead the Liberal Party between Count Ignatieff, who is the former son of a Rhodes Scholar, George Ignatieff, leading figure at the formulating NATO, the UN agenda back in the 50s and 60s. His son, Count Ignatieff, because they come from an aristocratic bloodline in Russia that oversaw the killing of the Romanovs and the Bolshevik Revolution. And then they got sanctuary in Canada, which is usually how this works, or Britain. In case it was Canada. And his son, Count Michael Ignatieff, goes on to lead the Liberal Party for a few years before Justin sets in. And when people obviously don't like his lack of charisma and detachment from human feelings, he has to step down, and Bob Ray becomes the leader. And to this very day, Bob Ray is a major anti-Russian voice, pushing a war policy both with Russia and I think also with China. And Chris, so these things are everywhere. These Rhodes Scholars, and in my recent article from last year on Whitney's site, I deal with just sort of outlining those Rhodes Scholars position that really came into the highest echelons of political policymaking in America with Clinton first, himself a Rhodes Scholar, mm-hmm. and people like
Rachel Maddow was one.
Yeah, she's one. I was thinking about his roommate Talbot, Stroke Talbot. Yeah, who's another key influential figure who ran Brookings for about two decades. And oversaw the career of people like Jake Sullivan, Susan Rice, who worked for Brookings after being a Rhodes Scholar. Jake Sullivan was a Rhodes Scholar. You got Ben O'Malley, who runs the Middle East policy for Biden and formerly for Obama, Rhodes Scholar, close friend and handler of Blinken since they were children.
A lot of trilaterals on your list as well.
Well, that goes without saying, but the trilateral thing is more of like a useful junior partner in this thing that came online around the same time as they were bringing about the World Economic Forum in 71. And the trilaterals were brought in 73 under Kissinger and David Rockefeller. But yeah, there's definitely overlap for sure. So it's just everywhere.
It is everywhere. It's, I wrote a book called The Octopus of Global Control. I mean, when I hear these things, I just, in my mind, it's tentacles everywhere. It's hidden to the extent that we don't really go seek it out, but it's in our face. I mean, these aren't people that you've never heard of. These are people that you see on television. These are people that are, in your case, in your country, just stopping the trucker convoy. They're, in my world, they're on MSNBC every night, five nights a week, Rachel Maddow telling everybody, well, everybody that takes the vaccine, the virus stops with them. And you go, well, that's a lie. That's not true. And you go, well, hang on a second. I mean, if I look back at Cecil Rhodes' original plan, it was to destabilize America from the inside and then fold it back into the British Empire. And it's like, well, I look at all these people that have Rhodes Scholar next to their name. I always just thought that's a club for smart people. They send you off somewhere and you get a little bit extra free schooling, right? Well, I guess you do get that, but you come back with a plan and you get installed in these positions and then you go about destroying the country from the inside. And when I see these people, now it just makes so much sense. So that seemed to have been the plan from a long time ago, was to franchise, have all these franchises for the British Empire and every else, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, all the Anglo world, English speaking Anglo.
It's the white world is the key.
The white world is the key. I joked that all these people out there that are like, white supremacy is the biggest threat to him. It's like, if you want to focus on a real white supremacist, go read up on Cecil Rhodes. I mean, that guy was out of his fucking mind and nobody knows about him, but now they're like, there's Nazis on every street corner. It's like, no, the real Nazis are wearing $5,000 suits, I assure you. And they're congregating in Davos or Bilderberg or elsewhere, United Nations, wherever they are. So
eight SS officers ran NATO's Central European Command through from 1958 to 73. All SS officers ran NATO. Yes, the Nazi. It's true. There's a Nazi problem in the world. That is true. they own Wall Street and the city of London and NATO.
Yeah. That's a fact. And they're
getting taxpayer money in Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about depopulation because it's a weird topic, but it's a theme that runs through all of this stuff. And it's eugenics in the 1900s, 1800s, 1900s. It's Julian Huxley running the British Eugenics Society. They're out in the open. I mean, they weren't trying to hide the fact that, they had some ideas. They were going to, improve the stock and prune the rose bushes, and all these things that sound like we're just going to better society, by murdering all these brown people that we don't want. So it took on like an overhaul recently, a rebranding. And in 57, Julian Huxley talks about the concept of transhumanism, right? And this blending of man with machine, an interesting idea, right? But again, in and of itself, nothing nefarious. You just extrapolate out where technology is going. You say, well, human beings could maybe benefit from technology. How can this technology help human beings? And maybe if we had artificial limbs, we could help people, and all the feel-good stories that you could come out of it with. But then the World Economic Forum comes around and starts talking about the fourth industrial revolution. And you go, oh, that's interesting. What is that exactly? And they say, well, it's the blending of man with machine into transhumanism. And you go, wait a second, are we just dealing with depopulation with a brand new packaging?
Yeah. I mean, that's you said it. I mean, it's. I think the key here is located in because I'm I'm a technological optimist. I generally am of a philosophical view that technology is intrinsically neutral, and it is specifically the moral intentions and values of the humans who have free will, who apply that technology to do either good or bad. Now, if you're a member of a death cult and you hate humans, you're a misanthropic fanatic who's extrapolating your own inner poison onto humanity as being, and thus concluding that all of humanity is this useless eater beast of a cancer on a Gaia, whereas in reality, you are, because you're from an oligarchical, useless ass family, never developed real world skills or human companionship, and you were groomed since you were a kid to have that stuff cut off of you. Well, I mean, okay, so if that's the case, you might find yourself in a position of influence, and you're going to use everything to advance that poison you have inside your heart. You'll make sure that if fire exists, it's only going to be used to burn down villages. And I think the problem that I tend to encounter these days, and I'm probably sure you've probably come up with similar observations, is that there's a reactionary, because we've seen technology so abused and misused by these evil bastards, people say, well, how about technology itself is the problem, and if we just had no technology, we wouldn't have these problems. And it's like, well, then it's like you're saying, like, let's just ban fire because there are these arsonists that nobody wants to look at. But rather than like look at the arsonists and put them in jail or do something with the arsonists, we're saying no, it's the fire that's the problem. That's what the oligarchy wants us to get into. They want us to be in that reactionary either or mode. Now, I think for the sake of the fourth industrial revolution idea, it's something that, you know, the foreseeability after World War II of an eventual crisis in the labor force caused by the increased rates of automation of machinery and processing of computing technology was something that people were discussing in the 50s in a relatively neutral way. Generally, it was still a naively technologically optimistic society back then. Mm-hmm. They were kind of drunk off of the defeat of Hitler and a naive goodness. I'm all fan for optimism, but you also have to be aware of evil. And there was a blind spot on the evil thing. So people were generally speaking very well of, you know, the future societies of the Jetsons, you know, people in rocket packs and stuff. And, but there was a truth to that. You could sort of force anybody looking at those variables, population growth, rates of quantitative improvement of automation and technology, could see that, okay, at some point, anything which has rhythmic constant cycles as a job could be effectively done by computers. If the things are more sophisticated, obviously it would require more time for computers to be more advanced to do a slightly more sophisticated, repetitive job. But pretty much anything that can be done with actions that can be applied onto a logarithm can be done by a computer. So there was four discussions already back in the day before we were born of like, well, what do you do with that labor crisis? The first, you know, the application of machinery, steam power to human activity economically did create a bit of a crisis. We had, you know, Luddites moving around Britain, breaking machines that they saw as being the cause of their joblessness. Right. And, the reality of the first one was, okay, well, if you have moral creative policies guiding a future orientation, then whenever you introduce new technology, like let's say, yeah, the guy whose job it was to, like, you know, walk around the cities with a little stick putting out the candles every morning, they lost their jobs when you put electricity into the system, okay? Sure. But we found that rather than seeing more jobs lost, we had more jobs created. Because there are all of these nonlinear, surprising things that are brought online when you apply electricity to a productive process, and, you know, more opportunities now for mind growth. So the fourth industrial revolution, I think there's a fight. There's been a fight over what would be its value, what would be its application and design. And today there's like different competing ideas of what it will be and what values should animate the behavior of these technologies of what is it? Is 3D printing, machine learning, which basically utilizes algorithms to take composites of anything humans have ever done and then apply in the form of something that might or may not be useful. Quantum computing, digital currencies, things like that, which might be useful for, or actually is very easily useful for a slave society if people you want to behaviorally modify, sure, right, with a behaviorist punishment reward strat. But at the same time, like, it's not an evil thing unto itself, because like, even if you have gold or plastic or whatever assigned to whatever denomination of what you want to use as credits to buy things or invest in things. If your society is animated by a conscious understanding of human beings give value to whatever it is, plastic or gold or whatever the thing is agreed upon, paper. If your sense is human beings need to have their needs met and their powers of creativity increased to leap over the limits to growth, which are always pressing on us, because there's always a limit to what we can do based on the ignorance of new technologies or laws of the universe that we haven't discovered yet. And our ignorance creates limits to what we can't do, or upon which we can do certain things limitedly. So we can only sustain a certain given, like if you go back before the Industrial Revolution, go back to like 1620. Okay, the average lifespan was maybe, I think about 42 years of age, high infant mortality in most of Europe. Really tough life. People had to work long hours. Child labor was rampant because you just needed to have kids work in the farms. And you could only, with that productive process in society at that time, you could only sustain maybe an upper level max of, I'm going to throw a number, but it's going to be a very low number. Maybe you could have on the earth at that level of technology, maybe a couple of billion of people. You know, certainly for the case of monkeys, you can't have more than maybe 20, 30 million monkeys of an orangutan species alive at any one given time, because it takes a lot of space and resources for those monkeys to consume. And they're going to use sticks to sometimes poke, you know, ants out of an anthill, but they're not going to make the qualitative technology of the stick making that much better. So they have a certain limited use of tools, but it's still limited in ways that humans are not limited by. So you apply now the new technology, you introduce some new discoveries, you encourage some new discoveries, and all of a sudden we have more space to potentially move into. When, you know, you have now electricity, you can now have maybe 6-7 billion people. You apply now new technologies on top of that, you can then maybe have 40-50 billion people. If you do, I mean, certainly the whole population of the world, if given a decent plot of land, can live comfortably in a size of territory the size of Texas. Yeah. With a lot of space in between, right? Like, not that you'd want to do that, but just to mental aid. So we could certainly sustain a lot more people. And the oligarchy, I think, with the feudal transhumanist ideology, and transhumanism is not a technology; it's a religion, and it's right. It's a religious way of thinking about humans as being defined by two castes: a master caste and a slave class. And the master class caste would be that which, like Julian and his brother Aldous, who writes about this in his own way in Brave New World, are see themselves as part of that upper managerial elite who will control the levers of the CRISPR babies who will be born into test tubes, the alpha pluses, right, the Mustafa Mones, and then the everyone else will be like programmed with either, you know, like a little mix of both being genetically modified CRISPR babies with a little bit of like neural implants a la Elon Musk with a little bit of whatever, but programmed to be obedient and happy slaves with a little help of Soma, aka psilocybin or LSD or whatever that, you know, they're promoting right now in this day or the next, and video games. Like Yuval Harari said it clearly, drugs and video games, best way. Yeah. That's not new. He's just basically, you know, giving lip service to Aldous. Mm-hmm. And so you got slave and master class, the Morlocks and the LOI from H.G. Wells, the Fabian's configuration. The other view is that no, these technologies should be at the service of human needs. So you could use AI or machine learning to do things like, you know, deep earth crust mining or deep space mining of asteroids, for example, where you don't want to put a human being in jeopardy in hostile environments. That's fine. Okay. Or maybe certain forms of simple medical procedures, you know, getting your tonsils removed. Maybe you could have like a machine learning type of thing there. That could be useful. Automation, also useful. But it all depends on like how you see humans at the end of the day. And do you see this humans as just these toxic animals that are just born to fight with each other the way the Darwinians say? We're all in a fight for the strongest against the weakest in a fight to procreate and spread our seed. Or creator, like, is that maybe the more bestial side of our being, which is all the oligarchs or materialists want to look at, which is that's where the Malthusian thing you know, this idea of the oligarchy being the master class managing the Irish overpopulated eaters or Indian, you know, eaters. There's a direct connection between the ideology of Malthus, how it transmogrified under the guidance of people like Thomas Huxley, a sociopath.
Grandfather. Yeah.
Yeah. Grandfather of Julian and all this.
Darwin's bulldog, as they called him.
Yep. Yeah, because they couldn't trust Darwin to argue and defend his own position in public for,
a variety of reasons. A hired gun to do it for him.
And he didn't even believe in Darwinian system. He even said it in his private letters, which are today public. He didn't believe in Darwin's system. So it's like, well, then why did you put so much effort of your life into making Darwin's thing become the hegemonic narrative of science that everybody had to adopt, which gave birth in 1865 to Nature magazine, which continued to promote this garbage, including global warming theory, man-made global warming, and COVID, everything up for the next 150 years. And how did Darwinianism become eugenics, which became then transhumanism? There's a direct, it's the same thing, but given new wineskins, as Julian Huxley even pointed out in his book on putting old wine into new wineskins. He literally just said it, but it's only for, like, you know, those in the know to really catch these double entendres that he throws out there.
Yeah. Oh, well, we've been upgraded. At least he thinks we're wine, you know. Could be worse. I wonder about this. So we've got a new rebranding with transhumanism. And then in Canada, which is where you're based, we'll make this a little Canada specific here. We've got a relatively new concept. Well, maybe not the concept isn't all that new, but the implementation is. This is medical assistance in dying. And according to what I've read, about 10,000 people in the Canadian in Canada took the Canadian government up on their offer last year to help them transition from being alive to being dead. And then I saw what was basically just panic inducing a commercial that was done by a high-end clothing store. Interviewing a lady, having a lady on that was talking, you know, about her upcoming appointment to exit this planet, and it's out on a beach, and it's stunning and brave, and everything's so beautiful, and she's such a hero, and she's such a martyr, and all these things. I mean, are we going to get, I feel like we're getting to a place where they're like, stub your toe, girlfriend dump you? Have you considered medical assistance in dying? Right. I mean, it's I'm goofing on it a little bit, but only a little bit, because I understand how these crazy ideas can get normalized once the media takes a hold of it. What is the sales pitch, if there even really is one, in Canada that we here in America are not hearing? Because to us this sounds insane, and I got a feeling that it's going to be exported to us in the future.
Well, Canada's always been a bit of an incubator for what the empire wants to do to the United States. And I'm sorry to say this for any of your Canadian listeners. This is a hard pill to swallow, but you got to swallow it if you want to really be committed to reality. Canada is not a country. It's never been a country. It's a synthetic creation designed for purely geopolitical purposes within a global chemistry called a great game by British handlers going back to the 19th century, actually going back to 1776, which is why that's why I'm Canadian and I speak English. You know, it's because America had, there were three types of Americans in 1776. You had the authentic Americans who actually planned and were willing to die for the concept of a new type of society organized by the consent of the governed, with the concept of the inalienable rights of the individual that are all considered sovereign instead of one sovereign giving, born into a hereditary elite clan or tribe, emanating rights that they could grant or take away from their serfs. That was the break from that, which was the norm for most of human civilization's history, was what was accomplished largely through the brilliant planning over decades. It was not through, like, I don't want to pay tea or drink British tea or pay taxes without representation. That was not what animated 1776. There was decades of planning tied very clearly, actually, to Ben Franklin's discoveries into electricity, which are not disconnected from the later discoveries of natural law that were put into motion or manifest in the moral domain through the revolution. There's a lot of work put into this. All that to say, there are three types of Americans. So you have the authentic Americans who made the history, who were willing to die, who were the creative bastions of that important moment in history. Then you had, the stay behinds, sort of like how you had the Gladio fascist stay behinds after World War II.
Right.
Sort of you had the same thing where like the Americans that were not American or today's Republic, the rhinos, right? They look and smell kind of like they're American, or but they're not. They're traitors. So you had the traitors who maintained a patriotic garb or surface appearance, but were always loyal to the British hereditary structures of the city of London. And they remained behind to sabotage and destroy the nation from within. Albert Gallatin, Aaron Burr being two examples, the Cabots, the Lodges, which today are major families in the Eastern establishment, always interfacing closely with the Roundtable movement throughout the 19th century, well, late 19th, early 20th century, always there. So you had that problem, right? And then you had the United Empire loyalist Americans who said, you know, we're going to maintain our loyalties with the British hereditary systems, and they were given sanctuary in British colonies of Canada. It created Nova Scotia, Upper Lower Canada, Quebec, Ontario. And so, you know, you have to hold that in mind. Then you have to look at, and I'm going to get at the euthanasia thing, but you have to then look at the fact that 1867, when we got our so-called Constitution, that was a fraud. Why was it a fraud? It was a fraud because it was actually drafted in 1864 while the Civil War was still waging. It was done because you had a giant pro-Lincoln movement in Canada with political power in the private and public sector. People like Isaac Buchanan, the head of at the time a more sane liberal party, who was managing to coordinate a twofold option. Either one, completely make Canada an independent country under the conditions that Lincoln is victorious at keeping the Union together, or number two, just join America and break with Britain, because Britain is friggin' Malthusian and you know, it is what it is. But they were smart. They understood evil. And unfortunately, they also had a lot of enemies in government. John A. Macdonald, our so-called founding father, the George Washington of Canada, was this racist, pro-Aryan, drunk bastard who wanted to have Aryanism as within our constitution of Canada originally. And they drafted this thing in a drunken sex orgy in Charlestown
perfect.
In 1864. Got it ratified, took them a couple of years in London to make our constitution, which essentially created a nation not designed for the general welfare, but to advance the interests of the British Empire, which for Canadians, we don't read our constitution. But if you did, you would see that it clearly says as a preamble, it is not a nation for, by, or of the people, or for the interest of the people. No, it's for the interest of the British Empire. And it says that in the opening remarks of the Constitution, with an organized Privy Council office in the core, lieutenant governors that have to sign off on every policy in the provinces, a governor general representing the emanation of the crown that oversees the policies of the nation. So it's a deep state government with a veneer of certain democratic mechanisms on the surface to appease, like, the opiate of the masses, the people who kind of wanted an American style independent government back in the 1860s and 70s. But we got this instead. And it was used ever since as a wedge at different times to keep America from working closely with Russia in the Arctic. We've been a block on that. We've been used for Anglo-Canadian and Confederate South intel operations to carry out the murders of people like Abraham Lincoln from Montreal. It's a chapter in my volume one of my book series. Yeah, that was Wilkes Booth, four weeks in Canada, where
didn't he know that. Openly, okay, that's great.
Yeah,
I mean, that's not great. But
Confederate Secret Service had their and that Confederate Secret Service had their bases of operations in Montreal, Toronto, and Kingston.
Wow,
running terrorist campaigns against Lincoln from the north the whole time. Albany raids. Again, Wilkes Booth was directly deployed up to Montreal, where he received his orders and his money. There was found a money order, a check signed for $500 from Henry Starnes, from the head of the Bank of Ontario, in his possessions after the murder of Lincoln. And Henry Starnes was rewarded for coordinating with the Confederates, and he was made mayor of Montreal in 1865 as for good works. So you have this whole weird, Canada is an intelligence operation. That's what it is. That's
right.
I'm sorry. There have been good people in Canada who did at different times emerge and use whatever political influence they could gain to do good things. That was true too. Some of whom died, and that there's stories of those people who died when they stood up against the British Empire. That's part of our history too. But we have to look at the popular narratives that are garbage. You know, I mentioned earlier on Pierre Elliott Trudeau being one of Rhodes Scholar William Yandell Elliott's boys, along with Kissinger, same year in Harvard, right before being sent out to Harold Laski in London, who was running at that time a leader of the Fabian Society. Mm-hmm. For Canadians, they've been trained to think of MacDonald, of Trudeau as our Washington and our Lincoln. These are sociopathic freaks who, I mean, it's a shame on us that we still have been led to believe this Kool-Aid. All that to say, you got this problem. Now, Canada is a place where we saw with the truckers' convoy, there's the best of Canada is found generally in the blue-collar Alberta, Saskatchewan, the farming sector, the outskirts outside of the core cosmopolitan zones of control of Montreal or Quebec City or Ontario. You do have people with grounded, salt of the earth, you know, values that are human, and humans will be human when their children are being put on a chopping block. They will do what you saw with the Freedom Convoy. That's good, and we need more of that. Politically speaking, from the establishment, not a lot going on there on the federal level. Now, unfortunately, the technocrats created something called. So, okay, when I said that the Fabians and the Rhodes Scholars worked together, there was the Fabian Society of Canada, which today is a big thing to be aware of. It was set up by five Rhodes Scholars, F.R. Scott and David. Oh, God, I'm forgetting their names all of a sudden, but it's in my book. But there's five Rhodes Scholars in 1931 during the Great Depression that set up the Fabian Society of Canada. It was called the League for Social Reconstruction with the mandate of creating a scientific management of society. They were all, not surprisingly, eugenicists. Aha, right?
Did they? Was their shield also a wolf in sheep's clothing?
No, they didn't use that one. That was designed. Yeah, that was a wild one. Eh? Bernard Shaw just went and designed that. But they were that, though. And then they had a political party that was called the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation that they set up as the political party branch in 32. Now, that organization, which again advanced eugenics, population control, the weeding out of the unfit, that was what they were promoting. Before the ugly truths of eugenics and euthanasia became publicly understood when Hitler lost and people saw, well, what is this tear garden for? Nazi health plan that killed like 300,000 Germans before it even extended itself to Gypsies and Slavs and Jews and gays. They were actually killing Germans first, who were statistically deemed to be not mentally fit, too low of an IQ, maybe criminal prone, or you know. And rather than looking at the sociological unjust conditions that might have contributed to a lot of these problems of, you know, low IQ and criminality. No. It was all assumed because they're all hyper radical eugenicists and thus Darwinians. They're kind of a hybrid of both. They were like, no, it's in the genes. It's somewhere in the genes. Right. And so the best thing we could do is to either kill the person by euthanasia or sterilize or a bit of both. So they were doing that. And they were doing that in Canada. We sterilized like 10,000 Albertans in BC. I mean, 30 US states, starting with Indiana in 1907, were already mm-hmm. doing sterilization of criminals and the unfit.
Oh, the Nazis wouldn't have been able to pull it off if it hadn't been for the legalization of it in America, used as the template where they could go, well, look, it's working here just fine and it's legal there. I mean, why should we pass up this opportunity to, you know, improve our stock?
Well said. That's right. They use that as the legal basis, and it was funded by who brought it to us? The Rockefeller Foundation, the Carnegie Foundation, the Wellcome Trust was another one that Whitney's dug pretty deeply into. But I mean, that's the Eugenics Record Office was tied to things like this. The Galton Institute was formerly the British Eugenics Society. It's still a thing tied to Gavi. So I mean, these things didn't go away. So you have different aspects of population control. There's not one thing, you know. And I think a lot of people, they get too compartmentalized into, like, you know, the environmental movement, look, and they just focus on all of the proof, which is true. Like, look, Julian Huxley created the International Union for the Conservation of Nature in 1947 and set the stage for the environmental conservation movement. And then he works with Prince Bernhard and Prince Philip to create the World Wildlife Fund for Nature in 1961. And he, look at all the things, and they just focus on all of the fallacies of man-made global warming as a tool for population control and deindustrialization. But they get too fixed, too sucked in just that. It's like, no. There's also this other thing of the whole euthanasia policy as another way of doing this, which they run in tandem. And then you got the transhumanist thing, which is another way, but it's all running in tandem. They're different parts of the same, as you said, octopus at the end. It's the same, they're all connected to the same nasty view of human beings are just some combination of an animal, a selfish, greedy animal, animated purely by the desire to screw over the weaker, to benefit yourself, and have sex and food in a world of diminishing returns. So number one, and because you have logic, they say we're also combined between these irrational, selfish, dirty impulses. We're also moderated by some forms of machine-like logic, of Aristotelian syllogistic logic. You know, if A, thus B. If B, you know, it's this very like, very, very computer programming type of logic that they reduce what the human mind does. And they say we're some combination of those two things. And so, thus, for the zookeepers of the human zoo, you know, we have to use what we do with the animals, reward and punish, and we have to program using a digital sort of analog of what the human mind is, using, you know, a binary computing system to pretend humans are machines to be programmed. But first, that requires that you wipe their drives clean of previous programming, aka Christianity, values, love of, you know, your traditions, freedom, God. That has to be, that's like clogging up the programming of what the hackable humans are supposed to do. So how do you do that? You need some shock therapies. Yeah, you got to put people through. And they discovered in the World War I period, you know, Tavistockian psychologists or psychiatrists were looking at all of the trauma cases of people who were brought into schizophrenic fits, profoundly compartmentalized, were highly malleable because of the PTSD that they went through. And they're like, hey, we can work with this.
Yeah.
And amplify using some assistance of electroshock research and maybe some psychedelic research. And they never did this for the surface reason, which was mental health. The idea was to always figure out how do you wipe the human mainframe clean and reset civilization, cutting us off of our past heritage, and then reset under new programming a new type of human that would be more in conformity with what Aldous Huxley writes about in Brave New World. That's always been the thing, always, with MK Ultra, Tavistock, Esalen Institute shit, all of that.
Yeah.
So the idea is, I think what brings us together is that they fundamentally deny the reality that is provable, that human beings have a soul, that we're made in the image of a living creative force, whatever label you want to put on it. The fact is, there's some connection of the finite. We're bodily finite, but we've got this infinite, eternal, divine quality that allows us to leap beyond the limits of where we're at. And as a collective, we can transcend the limits to growth that are always pressing on us when we're being moral and we're respecting the values of the future. You know, we're all making sacrifices for a better world for our kids. When we do those things, generally speaking, we can do miracles. You know, we discover things that no computer could do. We apply it for the benefit of people, and we can have more of us sustained at a higher quality of life at greater longevity with more access to our mental and creative powers. Super good. And we become more critical thinkers and less inclined to adapt to systems of feudalism that want to kill us or our kids. And thus we don't allow for empires to keep their shackles into us. So it's this whole thing that the empire hates, and they want to just reduce us always to just being these hedonistic creatures whose idea of truth is rooted entirely in the senses. You know, if that's all truth is, what your senses are, then you could, if your feelings are truth, then you could make your own reality. There is no reality, thus there's no right or wrong. It's all just how you feel. And you see the consequence of that here, like 50 years after the baby boomer psyop that, you know, deconstructed a whole generation of kids born after 45 using like bountiful LSD and other things that were like brought in from the military industrial complex, telling them to like, you know, you stop the Vietnam War by having like drug infested orgies and like have a big kumbaya. That was never going to work. And now we're like two generations into that decay of everybody making their own reality using mind drugs. And the effect is, you know, you can cut your penis off and think that you're fighting global warming and expressing your reality. Everyone has a personal reality, and I get a little frustrated.
Gender is a social construct. Everybody knows that. Yeah. Come on, blah, blah, blah. It's what's amazing to me is when you look back on history, you see that this has been going on for a long, long time. I think a lot of us are waking up to the reality that these maniacs are trying to kill us. And what have come to discover is there's always been maniacs that are trying to kill us. You know, that's their thing. They have this ideology that it's their planet, that we're taking up too much space on it, that everything would just work a whole lot better if there were fewer of us. You get that 74 memo from Henry Kissinger talking about our policy towards the third world should be that of depopulation. He starts talking about useless eaters. You know, you go, wait a second, this isn't just one guy. This isn't just some group that is having this idea. It's sort of universal throughout this predator class. And they hate us. We know that. They have no respect for us. You know, and I go to Walmart. I don't have a ton of respect for us all the time either, but I don't want to murder everybody. You know, I don't want to remove them from the planet because they can't control their kids in aisle six, you know, but I recognize that we have some deficiencies here. You know, I recognize this, but I think what separates us is that these guys have been able to whitewash their crimes through using terminologies. Like you mentioned, the Irish potato famine. It's like, potatoes just didn't grow that season, I guess. And then all those dumb Irish just didn't know. They just started eating rocks instead because they didn't know the difference between a rock and a potato. And then they just all died. No. They did. They were depopulating those poor people and then they covered it up. And so it makes me think, listen, we may get 75 years from now, they depopulate all of us and cover that up too and say, and call it the transgender plague that just came out of nowhere and turned everybody transgender. And then all these people disappeared. And it was just this thing that came from up there. And we were just bad luck. I could fully see that happening. I don't know.
Yeah. Some mutated virus that mutated with some bugs that everybody was eating for some reason, all of a sudden just wiped them off.
Right. Oh man. Listen, man, I could talk to you forever. I mean, I love these topics. They're dark topics. I fully recognize that. And it's not for everyone. But I do think it is important for us to understand what has happened in the past so that we can be aware of these agendas, these tactics, the same sort of people, not the same people, but the same ideology of these people. They're not very creative. They use a lot of the same techniques over and over again, so we can see them coming a mile away. So I appreciate you coming in to explain this to us. It's there's a lot to unpack, but for those that want to get deeper into your work, your books, where's the best place for people to find you?
Yeah. Thank you for the opportunity for the plug. This is a pleasure. I really appreciate this platform and good luck with all of your platforms that you're bringing online, man. It's Ryan, doing God's work. As far as my plug. Okay. So the books, I guess the best thing to do would be if you want to know about some of the crazy claims I made about Canada, synthetic Canada. I did a 4-volume book series. I wrote 3 of the volumes on the untold history of Canada from 1774 to cutoff point 1972 or thereabouts, and the technocratic takeover of Pierre Elliott Trudeau and what was exactly brought in as far as this roundtable program into the Canadian governing system in a more coherent way than it had ever been before. So that is found on my website on CanadianPatriot.org. The other book series that I just finished the 4th volume, co-wrote with my wife, Cynthia, is The Clash of the Two Americas, sort of taking some of the work on Canada, but expanding on that now, looking at the American experience. From 1776, the growth and the origins of America's deep state from 1776 to the present, and some looks toward the future there. The work on the round table in America is deeply embedded, especially in volume 4. and are breaking free of anti-China psyops. We just put this out. It's because, you know, a lot of Americans are losing focus about what is this oligarchy that they should be looking at. And instead, they're falling into a lot of the brainwashing that's just retrofitting crap that was that traumatized kids in the 1950s and 60s under the Cold War that, you know, the evil supervillains are just Russia and China who we have to prepare to go to war with.
Right.
No, there's something else. There's this other thing. So that's this breaking free of anti-China psyops. So right there, those that's a lot of homework. And lastly, the bread and butter these days is Substack. So if people want to follow my writings or videos on Substack, it's matthewerritt.substack.com. Yeah.
You're doing great work. People get over there, support Matt's work. By the way, Peter Zeihan would agree with you that Canada is not a country. He's been pretty vocal about that. He says it's just a collection of provinces that are all operating with their own self-interest.
That's the one thing we would agree on.
That's the one. Yeah, that's the one thing.
At that point, everything else diverges.
go to CanadianPatriot.org, donate Monero to Matt, support his work. Hey, if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression or the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you again later.